Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama.
And now, Chapter 5. Vrindavan, October 17, 1972. Prabhupada had come to Vrindavan to observe the Kartik season, from October 16th to November 14th. He planned to lecture daily at the Samadhi of Rupa Goswami in the courtyard of the Radha Damodar Temple, speaking from the book, The Nectar of Devotion, his own translation of Rupa Goswami's book, Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. On his western tour, he had invited devotees to join him for Kartik in Vrindavan, and now a few dozen devotees from America, Europe, India, and other parts of the world had gathered to be with him. He was concerned with developing his Vrindavan project, so rather than immediately rushing to Bombay, he had come here first, sending some of his leading disciples to tackle the problems in Bombay. Now, like a general engaged on a different front, he awaited word from his lieutenants in Bombay. He moved into his two small rooms at the Radha Damodar Temple, while his disciples stayed nearby in the former palace of the Maharaj of Bharatpur, an old building near the Yamuna. Although Prabhupada was introducing his disciples to Vrindavan, he was also introducing the residents of Vrindavan to his disciples. Already his group was encountering some of the same attitudes Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati and his party of pilgrims had met in 1932. The people's refusal to accept low-born persons as Vaishnavas. Prabhupada trusted, however, that if his disciples could construct a wonderful temple for Krishna and Balaram, the hearts of the Vrindavan residents would change, and they would accept his disciples. He tolerated the roughness and slowness of his disciples, and when Vrindavan residents came to see him, he humbly requested they also overlook his disciples' faults and recognize them as genuine devotees of Krishna. After all, they had given up sinful life and were regularly chanting the holy names of God. Prabhupada lectured both morning and evening. Sitting on a simple asan about 2 feet high, a bare bulb suspended over his head, Prabhupada would address his disciples and the few interested guests who sat before him. Some of the devotees had speculated that since they were now in Vrindavan, Prabhupada would probably talk on highly elevated spiritual topics, such as Krishna's ras with the gopis. But it was not so. Rather, one of his disciples would read from The Nectar of Devotion, and Prabhupada would interject extensive philosophical comments on attaining pure love of Krishna through the successive stages of bhakti yoga. While Prabhupada's talks were especially for his disciples, he also stressed that the Brahmins of India accept the Western Vaishnavas. And he cited dozens of scriptural references to prove his point that birth status, being a material designation, did not apply in spiritual life. Stressing preaching as the essence of Krishna consciousness, he urged the disciples present to continue propagating the Krishna consciousness movement. Prabhupada's disciples were thrilled by these talks and by Prabhupada's personal dealings with them in the intimate atmosphere of his rooms at the Radha Damodar Temple, which he referred to as his eternal residence, the place where he had actually begun his plans for the Krishna consciousness movement. His disciples could hear him rise early and begin translating Srimad Bhagavatam and dictating his purports. At arti time, he would open the shutters of his room and behold the deities. At other times, the devotees might see him walking on the terrace chanting japa. and they found him always available to answer their questions and help them with their personal problems. Tamal Krishna Goswami, Shyamasundara, and Karandar arrived in Bombay. Things had worsened, Giriraj informed them. When Mr. N had seen the notice in the newspaper, publicly advising that ISKCON had entered into an agreement for the Juhu property, he had become furious. Giriraj had gone to him with folded hands and bowed down before him, but Mr. N would not be appeased. He had gone back on all his promises and had cancelled the sales agreement on the plea that the devotees had not obtained the deed within a six-month period. The 2 lakh down payment, he had claimed, was now his, and the devotees should vacate the land immediately. Mr. N had shut off the water supply to Hare Krishna land. Several days later, a hoodlum had shown up at the entrance to the property, brandishing a machete whenever the devotees passed by. A friend of Mr. N had printed a handbill ascribing scandalous behavior to the American Hare Krishna devotees and was having it distributed at the nearby Vilparl train station. Although a few devotees had left and others wanted to, about 30 devotees still remained in Bombay. The first thing to do, Karandar said, was to find a new lawyer, and he went to Bombay's most prominent solicitors and hired a specialist in land transactions and conveyances. Next, the leading devotees and their solicitor met with Mr. N in his office. Mr. N was stubborn and uncooperative, and the ISKCON lawyer was threatening. A court battle seemed inevitable. Tamal Krishna Goswami, Karandar, Bhavananda, and Shyamasundara talked together, and the more they talked, the more they began to see the entire Juhu scheme as impossible. Even without Mr. N's treachery, just to live on the land was very difficult. The devotees and the deities had such poor living facilities that the roof leaked and the cement floor was crumbling. Rats, flies, cockroaches, village dogs, and mosquitoes infested the place, with even an occasional poisonous snake. Devotees were always contracting tropical diseases, especially malaria and hepatitis. So although ISKCON's new lawyer was prepared to take the case to court, the devotees were hesitant. Mr. N had said that they, not he, were criminals, because they had not gotten permission from the charity commissioner. They were on his land illegally. He said he would sue for damages. He even seemed to be on the verge of some violent action. Considering all angles, the leaders whom Prabhupada had entrusted to solve the Juhu entanglement decided that ISKCON should relinquish the land. Drafting a joint letter to Srila Prabhupada, they had Shyamasundara hand-deliver it to him in Vrindavan. Sitting in his room at the Radha Damodar temple, Srila Prabhupada read the letter from Bombay and then set it aside. He walked out into the open courtyard. In the last light of day, many birds were chirping, and the devotees sat on the ground on a duri, waiting. Prabhupada sat on the simple raised seat and began singing Jaya Radha Madhava. He had Pradyumna read, stopping him to explain a point whenever he felt inclined. He spoke of the special benefits of residing in Vrindavan, but warned that one should not come to the Dham to do business or to commit any offenses. If, however, a Vrindavan resident did commit an offense, he could still receive the special benefits, provided he remained sticking to the dust of Vrindavan. Night fell, and in the dark courtyard, Prabhupada continued lecturing beneath the dim electric bulbs. Visiting pilgrims came and went, watching the Swamiji lecturing in English to his Western disciples. After the question and answer period, Prabhupada walked back to his room, exchanging words along the way with Gorachan Goswami, the temple proprietor. Some devotees lingered in Prabhupada's room, and many Indians peered through the barred windows, although they had never cared to look years ago, before the room's permanent resident, Bhaktivedanta Swami, had gone to America. When Prabhupada was finally alone, he began to think of Bombay. Although hundreds of miles away, the occurrences there were beating on his heart here in Vrindavan. He took out his copy of the agreement he had signed with Mr. N. Then he called his secretary and began dictating a letter to his leaders in Bombay. He began his letter like a lawyer, answering logically, point by point. One reason his disciples had given for wanting to give up the land was that the charity commissioner had refused them permission. In that case, Prabhupada reasoned, they should try to get back the money and give up the land. But it appeared that the charity commissioner's permission was delayed, not denied, a small matter. Although Mr. N. had mentioned a six-month time limit for obtaining the charity commissioner's approval, Prabhupada pointed out that the original agreement mentioned no such time limit. Another reason Prabhupada's men had given for wanting to relinquish the land was that, according to Mr. N., they had failed to obtain the conveyance within 6 months, as per the original sales agreement. Prabhupada replied that, according to the clause in question, it is our option to rescind the contract within 6 months, not the vendor's. But the real point was that Mr. N. had accepted checks worth 1 lakh rupees as a down payment within the six-month period, and therefore the sales agreement was completed. Srila Prabhupada said, quote, "We consider that he has completed the conveyance, and we do not want to rescind, but we shall close the deal immediately, finished, that's all. He's trying to avoid the issue by tricks, and he has dominated you, and you are a little afraid of him, and he has fooled you to think that he is in a superior legal position so that you will give him some money. But this is cheating. We shall not give him any more money. Don't pay him any more. First of all, bring a criminal case against him. So why you should be disappointed and afraid of him? Our position is very, very strong." Unquote. If Mr. N. was threatening violence, that also was not grounds for quitting the land. The devotees were on the land legally and should seek police protection. Srila Prabhupada further said, quote, "Therefore, I say that you boys cannot deal very well in these matters because you are too timid. Now, whatever you like, you may do. Immediately, criminal case should be taken, but that you are not doing because he is bluffing you. He says big words and makes threats, and you believe him foolishly and do like he says. That I shall not do." Unquote. Prabhupada's conclusive advice was that the devotees go to the magistrate and tell him, quote, "We gave Mr. N. money, and now he is threatening violence to drive us away." Unquote. They should not be afraid. Prabhupada had not come to Vrindavan only to lecture. He wanted to begin construction on his new property. And the news from Bombay didn't distract him from his purpose. Every day he would have the devotees hold a Sankirtan procession from the Radha Damodar temple to the property at Ramanreti. He would also go out occasionally to see the site, still nothing more than grass huts, a wire fence, and a small stock of building materials. Subala, the disciple in charge of construction, was slow and reluctant, and Prabhupada sent for Tamal Krishna Goswami to come from Bombay and take charge. Early one morning, Subala left the land at Ramanreti, where he had been staying, and approached Srila Prabhupada on the roof of the Radha Damodar temple. "Prabhupada," he said, "I am having so much difficulty. I don't have time to read. I can't chant my rounds properly. I can't think of Krishna. I'm always thinking of how this contractor is cheating us, or I'm thinking of signing checks for labor and materials. It's just too much. All these things on my mind are stopping me from thinking of Krishna." Srila Prabhupada replied, "Do you think Arjuna was simply meditating on Krishna on the battlefield of Kurukshetra? Do you think Arjuna was sitting in yogic trance while on the battlefield Krishna worked? No, he was fighting. He was killing for Krishna. He was thinking of all the soldiers he had to kill for Krishna. Thinking of the checkbook, thinking of the men, thinking of the contractors, this is also like Arjuna thinking. This is Krishna's service. You should not worry about thinking of Krishna directly. Arjuna wasn't sitting before Krishna in a trance, meditating on his form. He was engaged in Krishna's service. Similarly, this is Krishna's service, and you should engage. Your life is full of Krishna's service, and that is very good." Subala was still unsatisfied. He complained to Prabhupada that the other devotees wouldn't cooperate with him. He wanted to go into seclusion in Vrindavan for the rest of his life and chant, instead of becoming a full-time preacher in ISKCON. Srila Prabhupada asked, "What do you mean no one will listen to you? You think that means they are defective? No, you are defective." Prabhupada raised his voice, "If you are preaching and no one will listen, don't think you should go away in disgust and save yourself by chanting. No, that is not our line. We must qualify ourselves so they will listen. Do you know the story of Mr. Beecham?" Subala shook his head. "No one would buy his medicine," Prabhupada continued, "so he became anxious. Still he tried, and one day a man approached him in his shop and asked if he had any Beecham's powder, and in excitement that someone had asked for his medicine, he died. Similarly, better we spend our whole life and die just to make one person Krishna conscious. That is our line, to become so absorbed in preaching Krishna, whether in Vrindavan or anywhere. We must save all these asuras from destroying the world." In stressing active service and practical results, Srila Prabhupada was exactly following the teaching and example of his spiritual master. According to Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati, to chant in a secluded place and not preach was a cheating process. Devotional service meant practical work for Krishna. The simple, positive way to control the senses was to engage them fully in the service of Krishna. Active service was the topmost yoga, Prabhupada told Subala, a fact that he had repeatedly explained in his books. In the recently published second canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, he had written, quote, "Here it is clearly mentioned that the inhabitants of Vrindavan were extensively busy in the hard labor of their day's work, and due to the day's hard labor, they were engaged in sound sleep at night. So practically, they had very little time to devote to meditation or to the other paraphernalia of spiritual activities. But factually, they were engaged in the highest spiritual activities only. Everything done by them was spiritualized because everything was dovetailed in their relationship with Lord Sri Krishna. The central point of activities was Krishna, and as such, the so-called activities in the material world were saturated with spiritual potency. That is the advantage of the way of bhakti yoga. One should discharge one's duty on Lord Krishna's behalf, and all one's actions will be saturated with Krishna thought, the highest pattern of trance in spiritual realization." Unquote. As far as possible, Prabhupada engaged each disciple in a certain service according to the particular disciple's psychophysical nature. But everyone had to take up some kind of work for Krishna. Since Prabhupada desired to build a temple in Vrindavan, then whoever would help him do it, whether they were trained or not, or whether it was their tendency or not, whoever offered him assistance would become very dear to him and to Lord Krishna. When a householder couple, Guru Das and Yamuna, agreed to remain in Vrindavan to help Prabhupada build the temple, Prabhupada welcomed it and shared with them the intention of his plan. He said, quote, "If you can construct a nice temple in Vrindavan for me in this way, I shall be eternally grateful. Because we are a worldwide movement of Krishna, and if we do not have a nice place at Vrindavan, then what will be the use? Vrindavan is Krishna's land, and in the future many of our disciples will go there just to see, along with many tourists and other friends, so therefore we must have sufficient place for them. I know that you are not trained up for being construction manager. Neither that job must be very tasteful to you, but because you are a sincere devotee of Krishna, he is giving you all strength and intelligence on how to do it. That is what we want. That is advancement in Krishna consciousness." Unquote. By the time Prabhupada and most of his disciples left Vrindavan at the end of Kartik, relations between his disciples and the residents of Vrindavan had improved. The people of Vrindavan were impressed by the devotees' daily Sankirtan procession to Ramanreti, and they were impressed by Prabhupada. Although Prabhupada felt that much time had been wasted, it had been a year since Mr. S. had offered them the land, he was now hopeful. ISKCON projects were developing all over the world, and all were struggling. The devotees' only means of income was from the sale of books and, to some degree, from their spiritual sky incense business. As yet, Prabhupada had no architectural plan for his Vrindavan project, but he determined to gather from his book fund and from devotees enough money for materials and labor. One day he went to the building site and asked a devotee to mix a little cement, and with his own hand he laid down the first concrete for the foundation. Hyderabad, November 11, 1972. Prabhupada had come to Hyderabad for a Pandal program. Big crowds attended his lectures, and wherever he went, even while getting into and out of his car, people surrounded him to touch his lotus feet. Although Hyderabad had been suffering from drought, a few days after Prabhupada's arrival, rains came. One newspaper suggested that the Harinam Kirtan Srila Prabhupada and his devotees performed so enthusiastically must have ended the drought. Prabhupada agreed. Srila Prabhupada met with Mr. N., who was visiting Hyderabad from Bombay. Shyamasundara still had a cordial relationship with Mr. N., because Mr. N. had been fond of his three-year-old daughter, Sarasvati. So he went to Mr. N. and convinced him to speak to Prabhupada. Mr. N. agreed, but being suspicious that Prabhupada might try to use mystic power to persuade him to do something against his will, he brought a guru with him, thinking the guru would counteract Prabhupada's spiritual power. Mr. N, his guru, and Shyamasundara all came to the home of Panilal Priti, where Prabhupada was staying. Prabhupada met informally with his guests, conversing with them over prasadam, until he yawned, and Mr. N's guru said, "Oh, Swami, you must be very tired. We should not disturb you now. You should rest, and we may talk later." "Oh, yes," Prabhupada replied, "I am very tired." So Mr. N and his guru excused themselves and retired to the adjoining room. After a few minutes, Prabhupada called Tamal Krishna Goswami into his room. "When someone asks you if you are tired," Prabhupada said, "it means he is tired. If you go into the other room, you will see that they are sleeping." He instructed Tamal Krishna to carefully awaken Mr. N without disturbing his guru and bring him in. Tiptoeing into the room, Tamal Krishna found both Mr. N and his guru asleep on the beds. He went over to Mr. N, touched his arm, and said quietly, "Mr. N, Mr. N, wake up. Prabhupada would like to speak with you. Come quickly." Mr. N, being roused from his slumber, obediently walked into Prabhupada's room, forgetting his guru friend. For 2 hours, Prabhupada talked with Mr. N, and by the end of the discussion, they had worked out a new sales agreement. Tamal Krishna and Shyamasundara, working in a separate room, drafted and typed the documents, while Prabhupada and Mr. N settled the final legal points. Then Mr. N signed the agreement, while his guru friend continued sleeping soundly. Later that day, Tamal Krishna confided to Srila Prabhupada, "I am so disturbed by these dealings that I can't chant my rounds properly." "That is natural," Prabhupada replied. "Sometimes when I am disturbed, I also. But I can see that I am making spiritual advancement even so," Tamal Krishna admitted. Prabhupada nodded. "I used to think how to avoid difficult situations," Tamal Krishna said. "But now I think I should not run away from them." "Yes," said Prabhupada, "we should welcome these. They give us an opportunity to advance more." Shyamasundara and Tamal Krishna Goswami flew back to Bombay with Mr. N that afternoon. According to the new terms, ISKCON would pay Mr. N the 5 lakhs of rupees for the government tax, and in return, Mr. N would execute the deed. But there was also a new time limit, 3 weeks, and the devotees would have to work fast. Prabhupada himself would soon come to Bombay to settle the matter once and for all. Bombay, November 25, 1972. Although Prabhupada had come to Bombay with hopes of finishing the land transaction, Mr. N was still delaying despite the new agreement. Obviously, his stalling was simply part of his plan to cheat ISKCON. Srila Prabhupada waited many days in Bombay, finally departing for a Pandal program in Ahmedabad. He left behind instructions for his disciples to get the deed on the new terms, or else to take back the original 2 lakhs of rupees paid as the down payment. While Srila Prabhupada was away, however, Shyamasundara, Tamal Krishna Goswami, and the others began talking about how even if they could one day get the deed to the Juhu property to develop Hare Krishna land the way Prabhupada had envisioned, would be practically impossible. Shyamasundara argued that even if they got the land, how could they really expect to build a big temple and hotel out here in the jungle? It just wouldn't work. Meanwhile, from Ahmedabad, Prabhupada continued to wage his Bombay campaign, and he requested Mr. N and Mr. D to come to Ahmedabad to try and make a settlement. They declined. In Bombay, the devotees learned that if they wanted to get back their down payment, as well as the money they had deposited toward the 5 lakh gains tax, then they would have to cancel the new agreement. They were confused, and their time was running out. One morning, one of Prabhupada's disciples, Vishakha Devi Dasi, arrived in Ahmedabad from Bombay. Prabhupada called for her and told her to return to Bombay immediately with a message. Out of concern that his leaders in Bombay not make a wrong decision and decide to relinquish the land, he told her to tell them that they should not, under any circumstances, cancel the agreement with Mr. N. Actually, he said, this is not a woman's job, but everyone else here is either engaged in the pandal or has not been with us long enough to do this task. Vishakha took the next train out of Ahmedabad and arrived in Bombay the following morning. But what Prabhupada had foreseen had already happened. The devotees had canceled the sales agreement. They were convinced that to get the land would be a mistake, and their lawyers had agreed, pointing out that if the devotees wanted to retrieve their money, they should cancel the agreement immediately. When the devotees heard Prabhupada's message from Ahmedabad, confusion reigned. They now had no legal standing, no claim to the land, and they had failed to carry out Prabhupada's desire. Giriraj phoned Prabhupada in Ahmedabad to tell him what had happened. Bhaktivedanta Swami here, Prabhupada said, as he took the telephone. Giriraj was saying that a devotee had come from Ahmedabad with a message. Yes, yes, Prabhupada said. What is the point? Finally, Giriraj blurted out that they had cancelled the sales agreement. Prabhupada was silent. Then, in a voice that expressed both anger and resignation, he said, then everything is finished. I shall be the last man to give up the Hare Krishna land to the rogue Mr. N, Prabhupada wrote to a life member just before leaving Ahmedabad for Bombay. Prabhupada was now immediately planning how to rectify his disciple's mistake. No money had yet been transferred, so perhaps it was not too late. Mr. N could not possibly understand why Prabhupada was so determined in his fight to keep the Juhu land. Not that Prabhupada had kept his motives hidden, but only a devotee can understand the mind or actions of another devotee. Mr. N was dealing with Prabhupada just as he had dealt with the Sea Company. He had cheated them, and now he would cheat ISKCON. He could only surmise that Prabhupada and his disciples were driven by the same motive as he himself, the only motive he could understand, material possessiveness. Actually, even Prabhupada's disciples were having difficulty understanding Prabhupada's unbreakable determination. Prabhupada's main motive was to preach Krishna consciousness in Bombay. Srila Prabhupada said, my Guru Maharaj ordered me to preach Krishna consciousness in the West, and I have done that. Now I want to preach in India. Bombay was the most important city in India, the gateway. And within Bombay, Krishna had somehow led Prabhupada to this land where he had begun preaching and had brought the deities of Radha and Krishna. In Prabhupada's eyes, the land was suitable for the large, gorgeous temple and the international hotel he had planned. Bombay was an important city and required grand temple worship, large festivals, mass prasadam distribution, and a variety of Vedic cultural programs. The Juhu land seemed ideal for a school, a theater, a library, apartments, a Hare Krishna city. So how could Prabhupada retreat from this rogue who was trying to cheat him? There would always be persons opposed to Krishna consciousness, Prabhupada said, but that did not mean the devotees should give in. A preacher had to be tolerant, and sometimes when all else failed and Krishna's interest was at stake, he had to fight. Another reason Prabhupada refused to give up this particular plot of land was that he had promised the deities Radha Rasa Vihari. He had invited Krishna here and prayed, dear sir, Please stay here, and I will build you a beautiful temple." When Prabhupada had been touring and a devotee from Bombay had written him that the deities were being neglected, Prabhupada had written back insisting that these abominable activities be rectified. The deity of Krishna was not a stone statue, but was actually Krishna, eager to reciprocate with his sincere devotee. So if using the land for missionary work was the obvious or external reason for Prabhupada's determination to keep his Hare Krishna land, then the internal reason was his personal commitment to their lordships, Sri Sri Radha Rasa Vihari. Certainly Mr. N. and his associates could never understand this. Even Prabhupada's own disciples could not realize it fully. Prabhupada had brought Radha and Krishna into very poor conditions, but with the promise of something wonderful to come. At his request, Radha and Krishna had come, and they were standing patiently, giving eternal benediction to their worshippers, while Prabhupada struggled to fulfill his promise. 500 years ago, each of the 6 Goswamis of Vrindavan had had his own deity for whom he had built a beautiful temple. But Prabhupada was empowered to install and maintain many deities. In his Western world headquarters were the opulent Rukmini Dwarkadish. In New York, Radha Govinda. In Dallas, Big Radha Kalachandaji. On a traveling bus in America with Kirtanananda Swami and Vishnu Jan Swami were Radha Damodar. In London, Radha Landanishvar. In Mayapur, Radha Madhava. And in Australia, Radha Gopinath. All were Prabhupada's worshipable deities, Archa Vigraha incarnations of Radha and Krishna, appearing at the request of their pure devotee for the benefit of neophyte devotees in various places around the world. To establish many deities was one of Srila Prabhupada's prime contributions as a world preacher. And when he would visit each temple, he would always stand reverently before the deities, taking their blessings, and then he would offer prostrated obeisances. "Be humble," he would instruct the devotees. "Always remember you are dealing with Krishna." And sometimes he would be unable to suppress his ecstatic symptoms of love for the deities. Through his representatives, his many disciples, he worshipped all these deities, but in the case of Radha Rasa Vihari, his involvement was more direct. Having taken India as his own managerial duty, he considered caring for this deity his specific responsibility. Prabhupada's fighting spirit to keep the land was so keen that he sometimes appeared to be fighting for fighting's sake. He sometimes even compared Mr. N. to the demon Kamsa in Srimad Bhagavatam, who had repeatedly tried to kill Krishna. Just as Kamsa had employed many minor demons in his attempts to kill Krishna, so Mr. N. had employed demoniac agents like lawyers, friends, and hoodlums. Krishna's killing of demons like Kamsa was his pastime or leela. He enjoyed it. And Prabhupada, as the servant of Krishna, was fully absorbed in this fighting. He was vigilant, militant. When Mr. N. bluffed or frightened the devotees, causing them to back down, Prabhupada held his ground. He took naturally to the fight. Krishna and Krishna's mission were being challenged. Never before had Prabhupada been so threatened or met such active enemies. In New Delhi, when he had been selling his Back to Godhead magazines, he had often met with brusque words, and in America people had ignored and occasionally heckled him. But no one had seriously attempted to stop his preaching. Here, however, was a demon working actively to cheat him, to destroy his preaching, to disperse his disciples, and to displace his deity. He was forced to fight, and his disciples, if they were to understand his mood, would also have to fight. Prabhupada was acting as the protector and the parent of the deities and of ISKCON Bombay. He had described in the book, The Nectar of Devotion, many great devotees have an eternal relationship with Krishna as his protector. When as a child Krishna had fought the serpent, Kaliya, Krishna's mother and father had been plunged into transcendental anxiety. They had seen their child entangled in the coils of the serpent and, fearing for Krishna's life, had wanted to protect him. The eternal mother and father of Krishna always worry that Krishna may meet with harm, and when danger appears to come, their natural anxiety increases many times. In this way, they show the most intense love for Krishna. Srila Prabhupada's mood was to protect Radha Rasa Vihari and also his Krishna consciousness movement. Although he knew that Krishna was the supreme protector and that nobody could oppose his will, out of a protective desire to spread Krishna's glories, he feared that the demon Mr. N might harm Krishna. Prabhupada's feelings of anxiety and protectiveness extended to his disciples also. Although out of duty, he often criticized and corrected them privately, before others he usually defended and praised them. When Dr. Patel, a Bombay physician, had criticized the way the devotees were living, not protecting themselves from mosquitoes, Prabhupada had said that because his devotees were liberated and did not identify with their bodies, such things did not trouble them. Prabhupada saw his disciples as children, with little worldly experience. They did not know how to deal with rogues and could be easily tricked. But if the son was gullible, the father would have to be shrewd and strong to protect his family. As protector of the devotees and of Krishna's mission, Prabhupada wanted to establish good housing so that his disciples could serve Krishna in comfort, even elegance. Prabhupada's spiritual master, Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati, had taught the same thing when he said that preachers of Krishna consciousness should have the best of everything, because they were doing the best service to Krishna. Prabhupada was therefore determined to establish his Hare Krishna city in Bombay. He did not take the attitude of a naked mendicant who cares for nothing of this material world. He felt responsible for his thousands of disciples, and therefore he took on so many anxieties. Mr. N could not know what motives were driving Srila Prabhupada, nor could he imagine the full ramifications of opposing Krishna and Krishna's pure devotee, even though the danger of such a position had been explained in India's most famous classics, Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, and Ramayana. Prabhupada was fighting on the side of Krishna. Therefore, Mr. N was opposing the Supreme Personality of Godhead. By Prabhupada's disciples' cancellation of the agreement, ISKCON's legal position had been weakened. But Prabhupada had faith that if the devotees just maintained possession of the land, their position would remain strong. At the same time, he urged the devotees to preach more. They should not think that without a temple they could not preach, so he arranged for another big Bombay Pandal festival downtown, which proved to be a great success, with 20,000 people attending nightly. Important guests like Mr. R.K. Ganatra, the mayor of Bombay, made introductory speeches, and the devotees also took an active part, organizing, advertising, cooking, and distributing prasadam, distributing Srila Prabhupada's books, and preaching at a question and answer booth. The Pandal festival served to lift the devotees out of the doldrums of their protracted legal fight and the austerity of their living at Juhu. During the last week of January 1973, Prabhupada met with Mr. N at the residence of Mr. Mahadevia. Although Prabhupada's lawyers had filed a criminal case against Mr. N, Prabhupada wanted to attempt an out-of-court settlement. He had always been gracious and charming with Mr. N, and Mr. N had always appeared responsive and polite. But this time was different. Gone were the smiles and friendly words. The two were remaining barely civil to each other. After a few minutes, Prabhupada asked his disciples to leave the room. Speaking in Hindi, Mr. N began accusing Prabhupada and the devotees of being connected with the CIA. "I will come on Monday," said Mr. N tersely, "with a check for 2 lakhs to pay back your down payment." "All right," Prabhupada replied. "If you don't want to part with your land, then we will leave. But think before you do this." Mr. N continued his accusations. "You people are calling yourselves the owners of the land, but you are just a big disturbance to the whole area, getting up at 4 and all this." "We do not claim to be the owner," Prabhupada replied. "Krishna is the real owner. I am not the real owner. Krishna is already there on his land. Why are you bothering us so much? Simply take the money and give us the land. Or if you want us to vacate, then prepare the check." Prabhupada had been speaking with restraint, but now his tone became angry. "Bring out your check and we will vacate tomorrow morning. No, we will vacate tonight. Give us our money back. Have you the money?" Mr. N shouted, "I will remove the deities myself. I will break the temple and remove the deities." Mr. N then stormed out of the room. That week, Mr. N was hospitalized after a severe heart attack. 2 weeks later, he died. When Prabhupada heard of Mr. N's death, he was at first silent. Then he quoted a verse Prahlad Maharaj had spoken following the death of his demoniac father, Hiranyakashipu. "Modati sadur api vrishchika sarpahatya," which means, "Even a saint is pleased when a snake or scorpion is killed." Mrs. N, although not as legally astute as her late husband, carried on the fight, and her lawyers, eager to collect their fees, pursued even more intently than she the litigation to drive out ISKCON. In April 1973, at ISKCON's instigation, ISKCON's case came before the High Court. There were tactical delays, however, and month after month passed with no decision. Prabhupada did not commit himself to construction on the land because he had no deed and no assurance of one. He toured the West, returned to India, but still nothing had happened to resolve the matter. Life in ISKCON Bombay was peaceful, but progress remained stunted, the outcome uncertain. Then one day, without warning, Mrs. N launched a violent attack. On the morning of June 1st, while the devotees were attending their routine duties, a truck drove onto the Juhu property. A demolition squad had come to dismantle the temple. Somehow Mrs. N had convinced an official in the city government to authorize demolition of the temple, a modest structure of brick and steel reinforced concrete. When Giriraj attempted to show the officer in charge a letter establishing ISKCON's rights, the man ignored the letter and signaled for the demolition to begin. Soon more trucks arrived, until nearly 100 demolitionists, working with blowtorches and sledgehammers, swarmed over the property. The demolitionists mounted ladders and began breaking the roof of the temple hall with sledgehammers. Others used torches to cut through the steel supports. The plan of the demolition squad was to knock out the steel supports of the Kirtan Hall and proceed methodically toward the deity house, wherein Radha Rasa Vihari stood. The devotees tried to stop the demolition, but policemen soon appeared on the scene and, working in pairs, would grab the dissenters by the legs and arms and carry them away. Police dragged the women away by the hair, while tenants on the land looked on. Some were glad to see the demolition, although others were sympathetic. Out of fear of the police, however, no one moved to help the devotees. One devotee, Manish V, ran to a telephone and called Mr. Mahadevia, who, along with his friend Mr. Vinod Gupta, rushed to Hare Krishna land to find the police dragging off the last protesting devotee by the hair. She had been trying to close the doors to the altar to protect the deities when three policemen had wrestled her away. Mr. Mahadevia rushed to the house of a sympathetic tenant, Mr. Acharya, and phoned his brother, Chandra Mahadevia, a wealthy businessman and friend of Bal Thakur, the leader of one of the most influential political parties in Bombay. Mr. Chandra Mahadevia informed Bal Thakur of the emergency. At the instigation of a Hindu and under the order of a Hindu municipal officer, a Hindu temple of Lord Vishnu was being demolished. Mr. Thakur, in turn, informed the municipal commissioner, who denied knowing of any order to demolish the temple, and who in turn phoned the local ward office that had sent out the demolition squad. The ward office sent a man to stop the demolition. The officer arrived around 2 p.m., just as the demolition squad had cut through the last pillars and were dismantling the roof above the deities. The order to stop the demolition was given to the ward officer in charge, who then stopped the demolition squad. Prabhupada was in Calcutta at the time of the attack, and when the devotees reached him by phone, he told them to organize the local ISKCON sympathizers and life members and protest the attack by mass publicity. They should also expose the persons responsible. This would be very effective against Mrs. N. and her party. Prabhupada mentioned various life members he thought would help. Mr. Sada Jiwatlal, the head of the Hindu Vishwa Parishad, should help with publicity, since his organization was a defender of Hindu Dharma and was meant for handling such cases as this. Mr. Sethi should help in preventing further violence. This episode, Prabhupada said, had been part of Krishna's plan. The devotees should not be afraid. The next morning, a photo of the demolished temple appeared on the front page of the Free Press Journal with the headline, "Unauthorized Temple Demolished by Municipal Authorities." Devotees began counteracting the bad publicity. Mr. Sada Jiwatlal turned his downtown office into an ISKCON office, and he and the devotees began the campaign. Despite the unfavorable propaganda, many Indians were shocked at the violence, and the municipal corporation unanimously condemned those officials responsible for the attack on a Hindu temple. Devotees, working from 6 a.m. to 9 p.m. at Sada Jiwatlal's office, phoned the newspapers, wrote letters and circulars, and contacted possible sympathizers. Mr. Vinod Gupta, a member of the Jan Sangh political party, which favored maintaining India's Hindu culture, joined with Kartikeya Mahadevia and others to form a Save the Temple committee. Mr. Gupta published his own leaflet declaring ISKCON to be a bona fide Hindu organization. As Raj met with and elicited the support of government officials, many of Bombay's leading citizens, appreciating the authenticity of the Hare Krishna movement, began to show sympathy and offer assistance. Thus, the plan of Mrs. N. and her lawyers backfired. Although they had been thinking they were dealing with only a mere handful of young foreigners, they soon found themselves facing many of Bombay's most influential citizens. Srila Prabhupada predicted that the results would be positive. A few days after the incident, he wrote, quote, "The demolition of our temple by the municipality has strengthened our position. The municipality standing committee has condemned the hasty action of the municipality and has agreed to reconstruct the shed at their cost. Not only that, the temporary construction shall continue to stay until the court decision is there as to who is the proprietor of the land. Under the circumstances, we should immediately reconstruct the deity shed. Barbed wire fencing should be immediately done to cover the naked land. And if possible, immediately in front of the deity shed, a temporary pundal should be constructed with our materials. If it is so done, then I can go to Bombay and begin Bhagavat Parayana to continue until the court decision is there. This is my desire." Unquote. Prabhupada also asked Giriraj to give full coverage of the temple demolition in his Hare Krishna monthly journal to life members. Prabhupada himself wrote an article for the monthly describing his movement and the events leading to the attack on the temple. He condemned the Bombay municipality for having the, quote, "audacity to smash our temple against the law and principle of religious faith," unquote. A clique in Bombay, he said, had conspired to drive the devotees from their land without returning their money, and he asked for sympathizers and life members of the Krishna consciousness movement to come forward and help him at this difficult hour. Only about a dozen ISKCON life members responded to Srila Prabhupada's call. There were hundreds of life members in Bombay, each of whom had donated 1,111 rupees and were receiving Prabhupada's books. But when it came to a personal commitment in a time of controversy, only a few were willing to help. Those who did help, however, were able to assist in ways that the innocent, naive, and uninfluential disciples of Prabhupada could not. The devotees began to see the entire course of events as Krishna's mercy, since many life members were now rendering valuable service to Prabhupada and Lord Krishna. In the past, Prabhupada had stayed in the homes of many life members, preaching to them and their families, convincing them of his sincerity and of the noble aims of his movement. These friends and members, like Bhagubhai Patel, Baharilal Kandalwala, Brijwetan Mohata, Dr. C. Bali, and others, were acting not simply out of Hindu sentiment, but out of deep respect and affection for Prabhupada. Giriraj, working with Sada Jiwatlal, tried to convince the municipal council to authorize the rebuilding of the temple structure. While doing so, however, he discovered that Mrs. N. had that very day, a Friday, filed for a court injunction preventing ISKCON from rebuilding. Justice Nine told Giriraj that he did not want to grant Mrs. N's request and that he would hear the devotees' case on the following Monday. This meant that the devotees had from Saturday morning to Monday morning 2 days to rebuild the temple. The devotees reasoned that although they had no actual permission to rebuild the temple, there was as yet no law to stop them. If Justice Nine ruled against them, then to rebuild would be very difficult. They decided, therefore, to use the weekend to rebuild. Mr. Lal, a former contractor, helped arrange materials, bricks, mortar, asbestos sheets. Mr. Setty offered a crew of laborers. At 8 p.m. on Friday, the masons began their work, continuing throughout the night despite the rain. And on Monday morning, when the judge learned of the new temple, he declared, "What is built is built. No one can destroy the temple." When Prabhupada heard the news, he considered it a complete victory. The temple had been rebuilt, and public opinion was swinging strongly in ISKCON's favor.